This week, we look at the cult of Mithras, and by the end of the article, you'll have felt that perhaps you are a raven. Then we'll hear from worshipful brother Patrick Day in the next installment of Masonic Mythbusters. There's a lot to say about MacGregor Mathers and his translation of the Abramelin. Patrick takes on the question head on. Did MacGregor Mathers pick the worst possible translation to work from? Then we'll take a look at the continuing series of Whither Are We Traveling? A somewhat generational look at the original 1963-64 publication as Brother Darren Lehners gives us a unique perspective. How well are we guarding the West Gate, if at all? Better investigation committees? Background checks? What's the answer? All this and more on this episode of Whence Came You. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 529. Off the bat, let's go ahead and thank our contributors, our fellows, producers, and legacy partners for allowing us the opportunity to continue bringing Masonic education to everyone who is interested in the royal art. If you're interested in finding out how you can assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. There are a number of ways you can assist, which include PayPal or Patreon, and there's also the shop, which offers quite a number of different items and books that we've published and authored that are available for sale. Also, all of that just goes right back into the pool to assist in producing your Masonic education podcast. Some changes to the presentation schedule. We actually had the next two presentations I was supposed to do got canceled and pushed out, one due to a snowstorm and the other due to, I think, just scheduling conflicts, which was the Illinois Lodge of Research, which has been moved to February. So those are all on the schedule. If you're interested in attending one of the talks that I'll be doing upcoming, head on over to, again, the website, WCYpodcast.com. Click on Presentation Schedule, and you'll be able to see the different events and things where I'm scheduled to speak. Most of them right now are virtual, as is the case with most of America right now due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But there are some in-person events happening later in the year, like EsoteriCon, where you can get your tickets at esotericon.net/tickets. That is going to be at the Masonic Lodge in Manassas, Virginia, which is Manassas Lodge number 182. Our good friend and brother, Joe Martinez, is the master of the lodge this year. Very excited about that. But anyway, enough about that. Let's get into this week's education. We've got a lot to cover, and I think we want to start with something we haven't done in a couple weeks, which is really focused on some historical esotericism. And the first piece this week is called Brotherhood of the Crypt, and it comes to us from the Masonic Philosophical Society's website, which you can find at philosophicalsociety.org. This article was published back in February of 2016. It's by Axel Savary. And here we go. The Brotherhood of the Crypt. Imagine yourself as a citizen of the Roman Empire. It is 52 BC, and a warm summer night's breeze brushes across your cheek, ruffling the tails of the blindfold tied tightly around your head. Perhaps you are a merchant or a sailor, possibly a soldier between campaigns. You are being led swiftly along a jagged, rocky path, your hands bound deep into the woodlands close to your hometown. You come to a stop, and you hear a series of passwords exchanged between your escort and a second voice. The words you recognize, but their emphasis and arrangement is strange to you. Your escort tugs at your arm, and you resume your brisk pace, but as you step forward a few paces, the unmistakably dank, cool air of a subterranean refuge fills your nostrils. After several twists and turns, your escort once more pulls you to a stop and says to you, "I can bring you no further, neophyte. You must meet him alone." With a gentle push between your shoulder blades, he propels you forward into the unknown labyrinth. Your heart hammers against your rib cage as you take the first step into formless dark. Your foot meets nothing but air, and you are plunged headlong into a pool of impossibly cold water. After negotiating several more trials of similar nature, you feel an unnatural warmth on your skin, and you begin to hear the crackling of a fire and the echoes of chanting ahead of you. As you step forward into this room, you are seized at either arm and rushed forward and pushed down on your knees. You are beginning to regret your foolish decision when suddenly your hoodwink is removed. You are blinded by the light of burning braziers. And as your vision readjusts to the new light, you see a man standing before you, garbed in a black robe, wearing a fearsome mask. Behind him is towering a stone stele, depicting a man astride a writhing bull, plunging his dagger into its breast. Plants appear to be growing from the wound, and various animals are depicted as sharing in the feast. The entire scene is bordered by the zodiacal sigils and cornered by effigies of the four winds. The man in black begins to speak. When the peace of our world was threatened by the great demon Ahriman, humanity had no hope of prevailing against such a potent force of violence and despair. Ahriman sought to destroy this world by inducing drought, thirst, and starvation. Not a drop of moisture remained in the kingdoms of the plants and animals, and the whole world cried out in desperation. In our darkest hour, the great hero Mithras sprang forth from the stone of the world and took up the orb of the cosmos in his protective embrace. From his bow, he let fly an arrow that struck the earth, and from this wound came a renewing spring which rejuvenated the earth, if only temporarily. Still, the threat of destruction persisted, and with the assistance of the moon mother Selene, the vital fluid essence of life itself was secreted away in a giant bull on earth. A raven, acting as the messenger of the sun, came to Mithras and told him of the forest in which the bull was hiding. Mithras burned away the withered and desiccated trees and forced the great bull out into the open. He captured the bull and dragged it underground into the bowels of the earth, where he wrestled it into submission and plunged his dagger into its breast. Trees sprang from the wound, bees were born from the droplets of blood, and all of the earth was rejuvenated by this great sacrifice. The man in black steps forward and cuts you free of your bonds, and takes your right hand in his, and clasping it firmly declares, "Behold the grip of Mithras. It shall ever identify you as being in allegiance with your brethren, as Mithras and Helios were united in a like manner. Rise, Raven, and take your rightful place amongst your brethren." The Dawn of Mithras. Although embellished with artistic license, the above account is close to the experience that the novice initiate into the Roman cult of Mithras would have had. Mithraism has its roots in the dawn of civilization, a deity named Mithras, making an appearance in the Vedas as the bringer of light of dawn nearly 2,000 years before his bull-slaying counterpart would appear in Iran. From Persia, Mithras made his way to Greece through Mithridates Eupator VI, a grizzled naval commando of the ancient Mediterranean Sea and king of the Cilician Empire, who helped the Greeks repel the attempted conquest of Rome. Mithridates was the first to establish Mithras at the head of a mystery religion. This fraternity, created and led by Mithridates himself, functioned as a sort of ancient special forces to be used in piratical incursions across the Mediterranean. The Cilician Navy rose to infamy and came to dominate the Mediterranean slave trade after the dissolution of the Carthaginian, Seleucid, and Ptolemaic empires. These pirates of Mithras also carried out an enterprise of kidnapping Roman magistrates and their families, most likely under the direction of Mithridates himself, for political motives as well as profit. These early Mithrists, who were in nearly constant opposition to the forces of Roman imperialism, conceived of themselves as a sort of hidden militia of the Mithras, the Cryphae, or Hidden Ones. They recognized Mithras as a god of righteous warfare, of resistance to oppressive force. Eventually, the iron hand of the Roman general Pompey shattered the rule of Mithridates VI, and his fraternal mercenaries were scattered to the winds, A few of these Mithraic pirates were captured and paraded through the streets of Rome as part of Pompey's tribute, the general then installing them as beekeepers in the province of Apulia. From here, Mithraism was rekindled and slowly spread northward to the teeming and lively marketplaces of Rome, and found welcome among the Roman Collegia, Association of Tradesmen and Merchants. Mithraism further ingratiated itself into the fabric of Roman society as the cult spread like wildfire among the legions. Similar to the expansion of Freemasonry in the 19th century throughout the military of the British Empire. At the height of the Roman imperial period, followers of Mithras ranged as far afield as the scorching fringes of the Sahara to the windswept moors of Hadrian's Wall, the cult of the invisible sun. Mithras was a solar deity and bore the title of Sol Invictus, invincible sun, in reference to his pact with the sun to restore the earth. Very few Mithraic liturgical texts have made their way into contemporary hands, as benefits a secret society, but a few scraps do remain. Some scholars, such as Robert Turkin in Cults of the Roman Empire, 1996, speculate that in performing the duties that the sun was normally responsible for, duties that Helios was somehow prevented from fulfilling, Mithras assumed his throne by his act of heroism. Within the Mithraeum, Mithras's position was always in the south, representing the sun at full strength at the meridian, on the entrance of the Mithraic crypt, and within the mythology of the fraternity, Mithras is flanked by two attendants, Cautes and Cautophates, who represented the sun at dawn and sunset respectively. Cautes holds a torch pointing upward, while Cautophates directs his toward the ground. They have also been taken as representing the vernal ascending and autumnal descending equinoxes, which along the winter and summer solstices were of the utmost importance to the Mithraic cult. Mithraism was a religious of the crypt, and unlike other Roman mystery religions, had no exoteric function. They held no public ceremonies, and the Mithraeum were strictly off-limits to outsiders. Because they took no public tithing, Mithraism had to adapt to the circumstances of the individual chapters. The mysteries of Mithras were held in tents on the battlefield, discreet taverns, and when possible in custom-built subterranean temples financed by wealthy patrons of the Brotherhood. These lavish temples, such as the Mithraeum of Ostia, would have been ringed in statuary depicting the several classical planets and had ceilings painted a deep blue, daubed with white stars. The regular meetings of the Mithraic Brotherhood were known as magic banquets and were held weekly, if not daily. They consisted of the brothers entering the temple in procession, determined by rank of initiation and taking up places around the edges of the Mithraeum. The master of the temple fulfilled the symbolic role of Saturn, and sat on a throne wreathed in solar symbols. The proceedings, on occasions that required no extraordinary ceremonies, the proceedings began with a lecture upon spiritual or moral philosophy, no doubt illustrated by the symbolism and astrological allegories of the myth of Mithras. Following this period of study, the brethren would participate in a symbolic meal of bread and wine, similar to the Catholic Eucharist, as a symbol of the feast shared by Mithras and Helios, followed by a communal meal under the canopy of heaven. The study of time and astronomy were of central importance to the mysteries of Mithras. One of the dominant artistic figures of many Mithraeum, the lion-headed deity Aeon, watched over the proceedings of the mystery cult. At Ostia, he was depicted as holding the twin keys of wisdom, the scepter of royal power, and the thunderbolt with the tools of a smith, a rooster, and a pine cone at his feet. He also has a serpent wrapped around him, the snake's ability to shed its skin representing infinity. Aeon represented unbound time in contrast to the limited and linear form of time personified by the Saturnian deity Cronos, and was often encircled by the zodiac. Mithraism came into being in the same era as the discovery by Grecian astronomer Hipparchus of the phenomenon known as the precession of the equinoxes. The precession of the equinoxes is caused by the subtle wobble of the orientation of Earth's axis and takes 25,920 years to complete. It has astrological significance in that every 2,160 years, the sun rises on the summer solstice in alignment with a different zodiacal constellation. The Mithraic mysteries were conceived in the midst of a change in ages. Mithras, as the newborn Sol Invictus, represents the victory of the fire sign Aries over the previous age of Taurus the Bull, the twin aspects of Cotys and Cotophates, symbolizing the addition of Gemini to the retinue of the sun, the astrological age of Gemini having preceded that of Taurus. In the Tauroctony scene that could be found in every Mithraeum, several animals are shown feasting on the bull, including a dog, a lion, and a scorpion. These animals surely represented constellations, though their exact symbolism and interplay within the Mithraic myth has been lost to history. The degrees of the crypt. The mysteries of Mithras were divided into 7 degrees, each connected to one of the 7 classical planets. The initiation of the first degree gained the initiate the title of Raven. This oracular bird, who could speak like a man, occupied a position between the worlds and was thus the first point of contact between the neophyte and the ineffable. Candidates of the grade of Nyphus wore the flamium, the bridal veil worn by Roman women on their wedding day. At the crescendo of the ritual, the veil was removed to reveal some particular arrangement of ritually significant objects. The words, "Look, Nymphus, hail young light," were spoken. These phrases suggested that the candidate held a lantern. The title of Nymphus implies that this degree represented an intermediate stage between the novice state of the raven and the mastery implicit in the rank of soldier. The soldier bore a mark, either tattooed or branded, as a sign of his commitment to the militia of Mithras. During his initiation, the soldier would have been presented with a crown on the point of a sword. He was then required to divert the crown to his shoulder, declaring that Mithras was his only true crown. The consecration of the degree of Lion was a ritual bathed in fire. The emblems of this degree are the fire shovel, the sistrum of Isis, and the heavenly fire of the thunderbolt. Fire being the enemy of water, the candidate's hands were washed with honey to ensure his purity. The ritual itself consisted of physical trials by fire, presumably similar to the firewalking stunts of the Hindu Pakurs. The candidate for the rank of Persian also had his hands washed in honey, but for a different symbolism. The Persian was granted the privilege of harvesting the fruits grown by the grace of Mithras' sacrifice. His emblems were thus the sickle and the Phrygian cap of liberty. We know nothing of the ritual of the Heliodromos, the sunrunner, other than that the symbol of his grade were the torch, a radiant crown, and the flail. The father adorned in his headdress, likening him to Mithras, led the proceedings of the temple, and it has been speculated that he and the Heliodromos fulfilled the roles of Mithras and the sun in the ritual enactment of the celestial feast. There is one gift that the mysterious brothers of Mithras gave to the world that has survived to modern times. Every time we clasp hands with a friend, a colleague, or a stranger in a handshake, we recognize them as brothers initiated into the mysteries of the cave-dwelling god of sacrifice. The modern handshake was birthed from the cult of Mithras and has endured millennia in its original form. It is obvious from what scraps of their rituals remain that some core concepts of Mithraism have survived in modern Freemasonry. It would be irresponsible to attribute the origin of Freemasonry to this cult or that society, but it is beyond a doubt that certain aspects of many ancient fraternities have been folded within the embrace of speculative Freemasonry. The Mithraic obsession with utter secrecy concerning the whereabouts and operations of their temples is certainly echoed in Freemasonry, as is the practice of greeting brothers by certain handshakes. As Freemasons, an examination of Mithraism and similar ancient mysteries will surely bring us closer to timeless and unwavering truths, glimpsed by so many throughout the vast expanse of time. When you kill a beast, say to him in your heart, "By the same powers that you are slain, I too am slain, and I too shall be consumed. For the law that delivered you into my hands shall deliver me into a mightier hand. Your blood and my blood is naught but the sap that feeds the tree of heaven." Khalil Gibran, Lebanese poet and Freemason. Well, there you have this amazing look at the Brotherhood of the Crypt, the Mithraic, quote-unquote, degrees. Just fascinating, and I hope that as I was reading this in the beginning, you envisioned it. Maybe we even just initiated everybody who is listening into the cult of Mithras. You're all ravens now. Just a fascinating look, and I really loved this piece. I have something of a obsession with these ancient rites. Maybe I feel like they are superior in some way to what we do, or maybe I'm just obsessed because I see so much in Freemasonry that was also in the cult of Mithras. When I think about the sun at meridian height, the junior warden flanked by both his stewards in many jurisdictions representing Cautes and Cautophates as the junior and senior stewards, right? Kind of interesting there. Now, next up, let's get into the next segment, which is our newest segment, Masonic Mythbusters with Brother Patrick Day. Let's check it out.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Did Samuel Mathers pick the worst copy of the Abermelon to translate? In 1893, Samuel Liddell MacGregor Mathers published his translation of the Book of Abermelon, thus more or less effectively relaunching ceremonial magic back into the mainstream. The entire situation is a bit more complicated than that, but it was definitely an important moment. Now, Mathers was a Freemason, and the Book of Abermelon is a book of immense magical ritual. Thus, it was important to both the Golden Dawn and some Freemasons of an esoteric leaning. But Mathers was reliant on the only manuscript he could easily gain access to, the BNF Arsenal MS 2351, under the title of The Sacred Magic That God Gave to Moses, Aaron, David, Solomon, and Other Holy Patriarchs and Prophets, which teaches the true divine wisdom left by Abraham to Lamech, his son, translated from Hebrew. Whew, that's a mouthful. Most commonly, it is known as the Abermelon. Mathers would translate this really long title into The Sacred Magic of Abermelon the Mage. The manuscript itself states that its date is 1458. However, the actual age of the manuscript is somewhere in 1750s. And it is clearly penned by Antoine René de Argenson, Marquis de Poulami. I'm not good at French. That was my best attempt. It says that it is translated from Hebrew. However, this is both inconsistent with the oldest Abermelon manuscripts, as well as inconsistent with Abraham von Worms himself, the supposed author of the text, in which he states that a magician should never do anything, any sort of magic, in a language they do not speak, or any language they are not fluent in, but rather to rely on doing magic in your mother tongue. So Abraham, being a German Jew, and in fact, all the other manuscripts of the Abermelon are composed in German, it is doubtful it was translated from Hebrew. It's most likely written in German. Now the exception being the manuscript in the Bodleian, the manuscript 594, which actually is composed in Hebrew, but according to Gershom Scholem, it is clearly translated from German into Hebrew. Other scholars concur with that, others do not. It's sort of mixed. Regardless, even the French version Mathers was consulting was based on the German manuscript, the Gelficus 3713, composed about 1608, as is found in the Wolfenbüttel Library. There are four German manuscripts, two of which are composed circa early 17th century, the other two being early to mid 18th century manuscripts. Then there is the Bodleian Hebrew manuscript, which is about 1740, and the French manuscript that Mathers relied on is 1750s. And there are one or two other German manuscripts, but they come a bit later. Now, obviously, the Abermelon is a German grimoire. It is even debatable if it can even be classified as Jewish magic. It proposed that it is Jewish magic, but Gershom Scholem believes that its original author had a good handling of the Hebrew language, but the author was likely not Jewish. Rather being a Christian grimoire wearing a very thin mask of Judaism and Kabbalah. Now, the manuscript that Mathers is working from is not a good copy of the Abermelin. Everybody knows this. The book itself, the entire grimoire, is broken up into four books. The French manuscript that Mathers was consulting is missing the second book, which is doesn't really take away from the rest of the Abermelin. It is a collection of magical spells and prayers, which are most commonly called secreti, like a book of secrets. And were examples of magic that Abraham von Worms believed were holy and good, and are certainly not devilish or trickery. Mathers appears to be totally ignorant of this portion of the text, and it doesn't really take away from the rest of the ritual, so kind of doesn't matter. So when people say, oh, it's missing an entire section of the Abermelin, this is what it's missing. It's missing something that's irrelevant to the rest of it. Now, this actually isn't uncommon, adding other books or addenda into a grimoire, or even binding together several grimoires, was not uncommon back then. The Lamegatum, which includes the Ars Goetia of Solomon, which Mathers would edit, it says he translated it, he did not translate it because the Ars Goetia is an English grimoire. But it is one of four or five grimoires found in a collection known as the Lamegatum, and the Lamegatum is a sort of mini library of grimoires. The fifth grimoire that is oftentimes found in it, but usually should be kept separate, is the Ars Notoria. It really is a stand on its own sort of grimoire. It doesn't really fit with the other four grimoires. Thus, it's not uncommon to see grimoires bound together, nor is it uncommon to see a grimoire with various sort of collection of magical spells or secrets or whatnot bound at the end or maybe at the beginning, or even mixed in with other grimoires. This is not uncommon, so we just so happen to find an example of this in the Abermelin. This is just how magicians worked back then. This was just part of the transmission of magical texts and the preservation of them. In fact, Frank Clausen has a whole book in the series called Magic and History, and his text is called On the Transformation of Magic, Illicit Learned Magic in the Later Middle Ages and Renaissance, which goes into this entire topic of how magicians transmitted magical texts throughout the Middle Ages. Now, the Marquis who penned the French copy of the Abermelin that Mathers is working from must not have been interested in the second book, and he just left it out. That's why it's not in there. That happens too. It is not uncommon to find manuscripts of grimoires in which the scribe removed a section as they deemed it to be irrelevant, or for whatever reason, maybe they just forgot to copy it. It's just not uncommon. We should understand that grimoires are working notebooks. They are not divine scripture that one may never change. They get changed all the time. The Abermelin is composed in such a way. Book 1 is sort of a biography of how the text came to be. Book 2 is a collection of magical, you know, operations, little spells and segreti. Book 3 is the Abermelin ritual itself, the entire outline of the entire ritual, as extensive and exhausting as it is. And then Book 4 is the magic squares. Book 3 and Book 4, as the text claims, are inherently linked and inseparable. It's believed that once the magician successfully completes the Abermelin ritual, the magic squares unlock themselves to the magician. Book 2 is clearly just appended into the text, and Book 1 we could do without except for historical intrigue. You don't need it to conduct the Abermelin ritual, which is just kind of nice to have for historical purposes, I guess. But it is not essential to conducting the ritual. Curious part of the manuscript that Mathers is consulting is that Book 4 is incomplete. This usually gets overlooked by people saying he picked the worst manuscript to translate. Not all the magic squares are filled out properly. They're not properly transcribed. There's some errors, some are incomplete. This is unfortunate. as the secrets of the squares supposed to be unlocked once the magician has successfully called their guardian angel, and their guardian angel will assist them in unlocking the secrets of the magic squares. So it just kind of, oh, that's unfortunate that they're incomplete in this manuscript. Yet Mathers was kind of brilliant. He interpolates as much as he can in these magic squares. He tries to complete them and fill them in as best as he can based on his knowledge of magic squares in general. He even tries to correct and edit a few. George Den, who is one of the most recent translators of the Abra Melon, produced a new translation back in, I think it was 2008. He compares Mather's work against more complete manuscripts of the Abra Melon and finds that Mathers is surprisingly accurate in his interpolations to complete the French magic squares. He still makes some mistakes, that happens, I guess, but it's surprising how much he gets correct. One almost ought to applaud him for how much he gets correct. It's quite surprising. Such should illustrate Mathers' particular genius. And truth be told, many who have compared Mathers' translation of the French manuscript generally agree that the translation is quite solid. That is not in doubt. However, it is really presumptuous and a bit unfair to say that Mathers picked the worst manuscript to translate. It's a wonder he found a copy of the Abra Melon in the first place. He was living in Paris, so he was reliant on the manuscript in the Arsenal. That isn't exactly his fault. There's not a database of these manuscripts to search through. And it wasn't exactly like he could just search Abra Melon, because none of the manuscripts are called that, but some other lengthy convoluted name. And these manuscripts were not scanned. They were not properly cataloged. The fact he found a copy is just purely good fortune. Oftentimes you'd be working off of a rumor and following up on it, or someone just happened to come across a manuscript and they were nice enough to let you know about it. That was just how things worked back in the late 19th century. Heck, we're lucky that so many of the manuscripts have been scanned and digitized on databases in the last few years. Before then, you might be able to pull up the library's catalog online and make an inquiry via email, maybe even have to make a phone call, an international one, or have to write a letter, and then you have to travel to that library in person and peruse the text firsthand. And some libraries are very particular about their manuscripts, even today. Some would only let them out of the archive for a few hours a week, and some don't want anyone handling them at all. Mostly because they're old and rare and fragile, and they don't want them to get accidentally damaged. We're fortunate that Mathers found a copy and translated it. Probably would not even know about this grimoire, or at least we would not care as much about this grimoire, had he not translated it, no matter how deficient his copy was. This may have been a grimoire that only remained relevant in German circles, if it were not for Mathers. Such is the case with many notable Icelandic grimoires, or even the Faustian grimoires. These are being translated and disseminated today, but not with the same hype that the Abra Melon has. And that is thanks to Mathers' work. One of Aleister Crowley's students actually was a native German and had a copy of the Peter Hammer version of the Abra Melon. And not even he thought to bring it up to Crowley when Crowley was attempting the Abra Melon. According to Mathers, Crowley was working from Mathers' translation of the Abra Melon. So if you ever hear someone getting full of themselves and saying something like, "Mathers picked the worst copy of the Abra Melon to translate," perhaps ask them how they would have gone about finding one of the 7 or 8 manuscripts, if they were lucky enough to ever hear about this grimoire at all, and how would they have gone about preparing an English translation for publication. That's right, give Mathers some credit. Given the circumstances, he did better than most occultists do today with all the resources at their disposal.
Wow, what an incredible segment on the Abra Melon and the background of MacGregor Mathers. I personally have a deep interest in a lot of these grimoires, although I am nowhere near as proficient and intellectually educated on the topic as Brother Patrick is. This was a great look at what was available in those days, and now we know when we're out somewhere and this kind of stuff comes up and somebody is very pretentious and says something like that in order to maybe sound intellectual, you've got a whole arsenal ready for you. Just either play this episode or tell them right off the bat. What would you have used? How would you have gone about finding a copy of this obscure, magical text back in those days? Certainly you weren't going to find it on the internet. Our thanks once more goes out to worshipful brother Patrick Day for this awesome segment. Let's get back into this week's education with our next piece. Let's continue Brother Darren Lehner's exploration of Whither Are We Traveling? Now, for those of us who have missed the last few episodes, we have been reading a series of articles that Brother Darren Lehner has been publishing called Whither Are We Traveling? And it explores Dwight L. Smith's seminal work, Whither Are We Traveling?, which was published back in 1963. And let's just get into this. Part 3. Whither Are We Traveling? Part 3. As we continue to explore Dwight L. Smith's seminal work, Whither Are We Traveling?, we begin to explore his answers to the 10 questions he posed for self-examination of the state of ancient craft Freemasonry in 1963. The questions he asked are as important and relevant now as they were then. This week, we look at question 2. How well are we guarding the West Gate? Dwight begins this section with an anecdote he heard in Tennessee that if a lodge isn't rejecting 20% of its petitioners, it's either very fortunate or very careless. He reminds us that this is one petitioner out of five, and that if this was occurring, the Grand Master would be implored to stop an epidemic of blackballing. Instead, he states this might be the best thing to happen for a lodge, except that most lodges are trying to get their new temple paid for. He continues, quote, "For years now, I have heard the whispered complaint we used to be getting petitions for the degrees from the good, substantial leaders in the community. Now we are getting, it breaks the text. Isn't it about time we stop our whispering and say some things out loud, even if they are unpleasant to hear? One of the conditions causing dismay in more than one lodge is the fact that the sons of its highly respected members are not petitioning for the degrees. True, they may be busy getting ahead in the world. They may not have the money, they may not be interested, but that is not all. Why should intelligent young leaders in the community petition a lodge if they have little or nothing in common with its members? If they cannot find in Freemasonry a social, intellectual, and cultural atmosphere that is comfortable, they will find it elsewhere." End quote. He raises some excellent points. This was written in 1962 and published in 63. Think about how many more men have been accepted into the craft that had no business being elected. One only needs to look around their lodge room as a quorum is barely being made for the stated meeting and see who is missing to realize that the West Gate hasn't been guarded properly. With a few exceptions, most of the men who were not showing up for meetings pre-COVID should have never been elected to be given the degrees of Freemasonry. We will see what the landscape looks like post-COVID. Smith continues with an anecdote about Teddy Roosevelt, who, while he was president, attended a lodge where the gardener at the White House was the master, and follows with this gem, quote, "We cannot escape the fact that men judge Freemasonry by what they see walking down the street wearing Masonic emblems, and if what they see does not command their respect, then we need not expect them to seek our fellowship," end quote. I would disagree, however, that men now judge Freemasonry by what they see walking down the street. In my previous article, I wrote about how our members behave in social settings, both online and in real life, and how it can have an impact on how the lodge is viewed in the community. I will not rehash that here, but I will say that Dwight is correct in saying that if what other men see does not command their respect, then we need not expect them to seek our fellowship. How we behave collectively matters. Most worshipful Brother Smith then states, quote, "Let's face it, thanks to two wars, inflation, the cost of building and maintaining expensive temples, and a general lowering of standards, thousands of men have become Masons who should have never passed the ballot. The inevitable result, then, is that the craft is not looked upon with the same degree of respect it once enjoyed. How did it all come about? One, economic pressure, for one thing. A lodge pays a heavy price for a new temple, so costly to maintain that membership must remain above certain figure." End quote. I no longer think that economic pressure at the lodge level is the leading cause for the West Gate being unguarded. I am sure that some lodges are outliers, but I would venture to guess to state that it is no longer economic pressure that is the cause of this. I believe that the pressure transitioned to come indirectly from the individual grand lodges and leadership bodies of the appendant bodies themselves. Economic or otherwise, we have seen the push for membership lead to the gate being left unguarded. Instead of finding quality, the statistics showing a decline in membership has created the push for quantity. Number two, we have fallen into careless ways in the investigation of petitioners. There was the regrettable incident to my own lodge one time when I served on an investigation committee. The petitioner was widely known. Apparently, he was worthy. At least, nothing to the contrary had reached my ears. Accordingly, I turned in a favorable report. The petitioner was elected. Several months later, from another source, the bombshell burst. Not until then did I learn that it was common knowledge about town that the petitioner was far from worthy. To correct the mistake, there had to be some embarrassment and some unpleasantness. It had been a sobering thought to reflect that many of my brethren may have questioned the petitioner's worthiness but gave him the benefit of the doubt simply because I had made a favorable report. Whence came the idea that a man, almost any man, has an inherent right to become a Freemason? Is it not a privilege to be conferred upon the worthy? And whose idea was it that if a petitioner was rejected, a grave injustice has been done to the petitioner? Is no one interested in seeing that an injury is not done to the lodge and all Freemasonry by electing one whose worthiness may be in question? Such an open-door policy is not selectivity. It is come one, come all. And Freemasonry is a selective organization. It must be if it is to avoid the fate of a score of fraternal groups whose names are well nigh forgotten. One only needs to attend their Grand Lodge's annual communications and read the jurisprudence report to show us that we are not guarding the West Gate. I have to point the finger at myself as well. There have been times when I should have used my power to keep someone from joining my lodge. However, I did not, due to a respect for the men who signed their petitions. I let my emotions for men that I respect overrule my respect for the fraternity. In doing so, I failed both those men and my fraternity. As most worshipful Brother Smith states, we worry too much about the feelings of the petitioner and not enough about the lodge and Freemasonry in general in continuing to elect men that have no business being Freemasons into Freemasonry. 3. Quote, lodges are not utilizing their most capable members for duty on investigating committees. In every lodge, there are brethren of high standards who love the fraternity and want to see its good name protected, men who would make more than a token investigation, men would really stand guard at the West Gate. But are such men appointed as members of investigating committees? Not unless they happen to be present at a stated meeting when a petition is received. You have heard it innumerable times. On this petition, I'll appoint Brother Joe Doak, Brother Jim Jones, and Brother Bill Brown. Just like that, the deed is done. The most important assignment ever made in the lodge is made with no more thought than would be given to who shall turn out the lights. In the hands of Joe Doak, Jim Jones, and Bill Brown rests the good name of Freemasonry, even though they know nothing at all about making an investigation and care less. But Joe Doak, Jim Jones, and Bill Brown were present at the stated meeting. Perish the thought that one not present be used now and then. All of us have seen masters appoint investigating committees literally hundreds of times, but on how many occasions have we seen evidence of careful thought in the selection of personnel for those committees? Men of high caliber and ability are available. Why are we not using them? Is it for fear they might turn in an unfavorable report? While I agree with Dwight in stating that not every member is a good investigator, I would state that assigning members who are not making it to meeting on a regular basis to be on an investigation committee is pure folly. If a member cannot live up to his one most important Masonic obligation, which is to make the stated meetings, then assigning them to a committee is handicapping that committee from being able to do their due diligence in the investigating process. While it's one thing to assign a member that might be missing from the particular meeting, but who normally is present, is acceptable. Assigning Joe Joke to be on a committee to investigate a potential member when Joe's not showing up regularly to meetings will end one of two ways. One, Joe will not heed the order of his master, will not engage with the other members of the committee, and eventually be replaced by someone who actually cares about his Masonic responsibilities. Two, Joe will heed the order of his master, but in doing so, he sets the wrong example for the candidate. Is it really a good idea to have someone that doesn't care enough to show up to meetings interview a potential candidate? Are they going to ask the proper questions? Are they going to care if the West Gate is guarded? In a worst-case scenario, maybe they'll let slip the candidate that they don't normally show up for meetings, which then sets an impression into the candidate that it's okay for them to do the same. If we want investigations done properly, then we must have members that care enough about Freemasonry to be present on the committees. Someone who isn't present at meetings on a regular basis does not fall into this category in my mind. Quote, "You have heard me say it before, and you shall hear me say it as long as I have a voice and a pen. In Freemasonry, there is simply no substitute for quality. We are accepting too many petitions, who can pay the fee, and little else. Too many men who have no conception of what Freemasonry is or what it seeks to do, and who care not one whit about increasing their moral stature. Too many men who look upon ancient craft masonry with contempt, who are interested in using it only as a springboard from which to gain a prestige symbol, and we had better start applying the brakes while there is yet time." End quote. I agree that we should be pushing quality over quantity, but I do think that we also need to have leadership at the Grand Lodge level that is no longer afraid of hurting feelings for fear of a mass exodus of membership. Grand Lodges need to clearly decide what type of organization they want Freemasonry to be in their jurisdictions. Instead, they allow each lodge to be what it wants to be, and as long as that lodge follows the rules, they do not care if the lodge is a social club, supper club, fight club, he-man woman haters club, etc. Okay, I'm being facetious. My point is that it has been my experience that there is no clear message from the Grand Master Grand Lodge line which states that the minimum standards need to be met at each meeting. And while it shouldn't really be the job of the Grand Lodge to do this, there needs to be some enforcement of standards, continuing to allow lodges where the master needs to be prompted continually, or worse yet, where the officers are reading ritual out of a monitor directly, does not help matters of quality. We should, at the minimum, have a standard dress code of business attire. I'm talking about suits, gentlemen. At all lodge functions, we should have minimum requirements for a master and wardens of the lodge. Now, maybe you are from one of the jurisdictions where these standards are enforced. If that is the case, then continue to keep them, because once they're gone, then they are most likely never coming back. In my next article, I will explore the next question most Worshipful Brother Smith poses, which is, has Freemasonry become too easy to obtain? Darren A. Laners. What a great generational X, even millennial type look at this particular piece. I have to say, guarding the West Gate is something that we have been discussing for years now, and I think is interesting. You know, Darren has said before that if the West Gate were properly guarded, he may not have made the cut. And I think that goes for a lot of us. But maybe we're exceptions to the rule, or we could be, in general, being self-deprecating. Maybe we are worthy, right? But what is interesting here is that Most Worshipful Brother Smith has made now, in two particular instances, references to appointing or electing people who aren't typically at the meetings. He talked about electing a man of pomp and circumstance in the community to be the master of the lodge. I'm not sure if that was a great idea. I'm not real sure if I believe in that. And in here, he says, you know, appoint people who aren't at the lodge meeting. I also think that's a bummer. I agree wholeheartedly, I think, with Darren. And I think I agree with him for the same reasons, that I believe in Freemasonry so much that I never missed a meeting. I was a second shift worker working with airplanes at a regional airport in the wind, snow, and rain. Every day, I worked from 1:30 to 9:30, and you know when you fill out the availability form for your employment, I made sure that I said, I cannot be here on a Monday night. It's basically, you want to consider it, you know, my spiritual time. That's my lodge night. Monday night is my lodge night. So in 7 or 8 years that I worked for this particular company, they scheduled me for a Monday night a couple times, and I just told them, I won't be here. You guys know the thing, right? And they amended the schedule. They knew, because that was my one stipulation. It was always that I had to be at Lodge. And I, in Waukegan 78, met weekly, every single week. And that's just the way it was. It was either ritual practice or a degree or fellowship or a stated. It was one of the four that was always happening every single Monday. It was really rare that we didn't meet on a Monday just to eat even, break bread together. And I loved that. I love weekly Masonic meetings, to be honest with you. I think it breeds a specific type of brother who is really dedicated. And I don't mean to say that, you know, if you didn't have this experience, you're not dedicated. But for me, it was crucial. And I feel like attending as much as possible is really important. And I gave 9 years of my Masonic life to my Mother Lodge every Monday for 7 years. Well, 9 years. I didn't miss a meeting. So for 9 years, every Monday, I think I missed 3 or 4 meetings in 9 years. Just tossing that out there. I mean, that's me. That's the kind of person I am. I'm really dedicated in that fashion. I made sure that I aligned my life and my work and family life around that one commitment. It's kind of like people who say, you know, I'm always going to go to church on Sunday, and they plan birthday parties. Well, we can't do it on Sunday morning. You have to be in the afternoon because we got church in the morning. Well, it's the same thing with Lodge for me. They're like, oh, your son's birthday's on Monday. Yep, so we're going to have his birthday on Sunday. We're going to do a birthday party on Sunday night because I have Lodge on Monday night. Or we push it to Tuesday. It's just the way it is for me. But I would love to ask our Craftsman Plus, what are your thoughts on assigning things to a brother who is not typically there at every meeting? Do you think that that's a way to pull them back into the fold? Do you think it just offers somebody who typically doesn't go to a lodge a opportunity to serve? Or do you think it's a bad idea just based on the fact that they never show up, so that must be a blanket reason for them never to be chosen? I'm curious on your thoughts there. I think it could go either way. This week, I am foregoing the tarot card reading. However, for our Craftsman Plus, I will draw a card and I'll toss it up in there for your discussion, but we'll leave that out of the podcast this week. And next week we'll be back. We'll have a special guest, Brother Frank Conway, the author of The Masonic Pageant, The Story of the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction. This is a really big deal, guys, because Brother Frank Conway put together this awesome book. Let's face it, it doesn't get a lot of press, and there may be a reason for that. It's a fantastic book that gives almost the equivalent of the Scottish Rite Ritual Guide and Monitor that's put out by De Hoyos and the Southern Jurisdiction. Now, imagine that book having an equivalent for the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction, which really hasn't ever existed. Well, it does exist, brothers, and it is a great book. And we're going to talk to Frank Conway and Brother Chris Stebbins, who is a legacy partner of the show. He helped put together this show. This is Chris's episode, and he chose to get Brother Frank Conway on for this event. And we're really excited about this awesome legacy partner episode that's going to be up next week. After that, we've got another guest lined up that we'll keep secret until I get confirmation of the recording date. One more time, I want to thank our producers, fellows contributors, and our legacy partners like Chris Stebbins for all that he does for the program. I want to thank Brother Patrick Day, worshipful Brother Patrick Day, for his work on the Masonic Mythbuster segment. Really cool stuff, really enjoying it. And we'll talk to you all next week. And until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.